Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Economically Yours. We are here trying to revolutionize the content space in the finance stream. And we would love if you could please like, share, and subscribe our channel on YouTube and all other platforms. So talking about revolutionizing things, if you love food, you will consider Sanjeev Kapoor a revolutionary. But when it comes to fintech and banking, it is Sanjeev Kumar whom we recognize as a revolutionary. With over 10 years of experience in financial technology, Sanjeev has donned various hats, be it an advisory role for the government or being the fintech collaboration consultant at ICICI Securities. He has also had the pleasure of working with the Royal Bank of Scotland, Citibank, and Australia delegation. His latest entrepreneurial venture is Whitesite, which is reimagining fintech research for the global markets. He's currently also the strategic advisor at a UK-based firm. He has been an active speaker at major conferences like Asia Berlin Fintech Summit, Barclays Rise, The Future of Money, and Fintech Great Zone. Apart from the stellar industry experience that he has, he has completed his bachelor's in technology from IIIT Allahabad and an MBA from IIM Calcutta. So my first question is fintech is revolutionizing the finance ecosystem today, but when did you realize that you have got to be an integral part of this revolution?
First of all, thank you, Darshan, for a very generous introduction and happy to share my journey into fintech and when I started sensing the opportunity that the fintech industry was presenting towards us. So I was working for a data analytics company for telecommunication industry back in 2017. And before that, I had worked, as you already mentioned, in banking domain, in technology domain, who were providing services to financial institutions. So I had an inkling of, you know, what's happening in the banking, what's happening in the technology industry, which will impact banking. And that is when one of my colleagues was, you know, starting something in fintech in the UK market. And she reached out to me that, why don't we do it together? Would you be willing to, you know, try new things and, you know, leave a very well-cushioned job and start something in a totally emerging market, emerging sector? So I said, okay, why not? Given that I have known the industry a little bit and I know what are the problems the banks have, the customers of the banks face when they have to interact with the bank. And just like every industry has been going through a transformational journey of itself, like telecommunication, e-commerce, entertainment, banking had been a little behind that transformation journey. So I had a conviction that, you know, banking, given that the importance of the industry in both driving the financial economy, but also the real economy, has to go through the same transformation journey. So that was the moment when I felt, okay, probably I could be a part of this transformation journey. And rather than witnessing it as a bystander, become a part of it and you know, do something that makes me, someone who wants to not just witness, but also influence and impacts the way the journey progresses. So that's how the whole thing panned out.
Great, great, superb. I think that's a very great line of events that has happened in your career per se to put you into this particular industry. But talking about the industry as a whole, right, and relating it with India and understanding the importance of fintech. So the last podcast we had, right, so I remember that one of this guest had mentioned that tech is no longer a sector today. Tech has become an industry in general. So extending that, how important do you think that industry is, and how important is the role of finance with respect to that industry's growth, and extending that again to India's growth overall? So if today we have to say that in 2027, India probably will achieve the $5 trillion GDP mark, $5 trillion mark, what role will fintech play in that?
Okay, let me answer this in a different way. So I was actually in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia last week, and the country is on the move, right? What's happening in Saudi, it's unimaginable. I have never imagined that a country which is as closed and as conventional and as traditional like Saudi can be as open and as fast and as innovative that they are going through. And it's a socio-economic transformation that is happening there. Of course, you know, driven by the head of the government, the Royal Crown Prince, who is driving the whole transformation agenda. But if you look at the way they are the transformation journey in Saudi is happening, it is opening up a lot of opportunity for tech industries, because Saudi is a very oil-driven economy, right? And their goal is by vision, you know, by 2030, they want to diversify away from oil. And currently their non-oil economy is very minuscule. It's like, I don't know, 150 billion. And they want to grow it to 1 trillion, right? So it's like almost, you know, 7-8 times growth that they want to achieve. Yeah. If you look at the Indian counterpart story, it's very similar, right? Currently, we have around 2 or 3 trillion economy, and we are looking to double it. And given that we are in a democracy, we have our own challenges, right? But at the end of the day, if you look at the governance structure that we are following in India, it's very, you know, kind of top down. It's very vision oriented, that you set up your target, that you want to do certain things digitally, and government leads the way. So that's why I brought the kind of example of Saudi, because there also the government is leading the digital transformation, just like in India, the government is leading the digital transformation, whether you talk about setting up infrastructure like UPI, India Stack, Oaken, whatnot, but also assisting it with a very forward-looking regulatory practice by enabling access to new players to come in and innovate. So those are the things that I see that in India, given that the government is very digital focused. The second thing which is very similar in India and Saudi is the demographic. 65% of the population in Saudi is below 35. We have very similar demographic structure. So if you look at the demand side, huge demand for digital services, and of course, by corollary, digital financial services. Infrastructure is ready, on which the supply side can build innovative solution, which kind of addresses the demand side appetite. And that is how I see that India is going to progress on a very fast forward trajectory towards accepting and iterating over digital financial services.
Okay, so you brought up infrastructure, within which we talk about UPI, and now we also have like the QR scanning code and NFC payments and their likes, right? So in that particular section, I agree that India is progressing like exponentially, but we also have another section or another department where with the mode and the way of digitizing these things, right? So when we talk about that, we not only talk about how can you like do a bank-to-bank transfer online with respect to UPI and the likes, but also what other means of payments can come in. And that is where today we have digital currency, like India is coming up with its own digital currency. And in that trajectory, we also have crypto in line. So what are your views with respect to the digital currency that India is bringing up, and also India's strong, views against it, but the economy, the regulators and the authorities are strongly against the cryptocurrency, right? So what are your views against that, and how do you think that India should tackle this with respect to digital currency and the crypto outlook?
So quite a few nuanced questions embedded in the statement that you just made. So let me try to unpack it a little bit. So on crypto, if you look at the whole story that has been panning out across different parts of the world, we have just realized that, you know, unless the entire crypto story is kind of being driven by the bigger fan theory, which is the NFT word, that, okay, for me, a JPEG can be worth millions of dollars, for you, it could be worthless, right? So as long as I can find a bigger fan who is willing to pay more than what I paid for the NFT, it's fine. And that's what many people call Ponzi scheme or whatever, but it's basically a bigger fan theory. As long as you believe you can find a bigger fan, you want to be in the market. The same is happening with unbagged stable coins or crypto or centralized exchanges. The same story is happening. There the story is bigger fool theory. So you know that certain asset is overpriced, but you're willing to pay even more to acquire it because you know there's a bigger pool that you can sell it to even at a higher price, right? And that is what is happening in the industry. And, you know, thankfully, the Indian government has taken that stand for, you know, last 4 or 5 years. You know, the whole Supreme Court story and, you know, the lobby going against it, winning it, and then RBI was on the back foot. But if you look at it, see, there are two kinds of players that I see are active in crypto industry. A, Western market, where consumers understand, you know, they are digital savvy, they are financial savvy relatively. And they face the problem not in terms of their currency is not weak, but they are in a very low interest rate environment. In the UK, in the US, they're like 1%, below 1% environments. They have to actively look for alternate investments where they can gain better returns. That is one part of the world. The other part of the world is smaller countries like Bahamas or you know, other countries where the currency, the local currency is so weak that I don't want to keep my money, my asset in local currency because I don't know how much volatility my local currency is going to witness, right? So those kind of two countries have an actual use case for adoption of crypto. For a country like India, if you ask me, we don't have either of the use case. Our currency is very stable. Our government has, you know, a rather stable forex reserves. We trust the government. The country is so big that it will not disappear tomorrow. And we have been a moderately high interest rate environment for a very long time. So all this push that adoption came from the consumers, it was all driven by creating FOMO in the industry that you're going to miss the bus. So join as soon as you can. If you remember all the crypto exchanges advertisement that used to come on the TV, it was all targeted as between 18 to 24 years of age of people. The get rich quick scheme. And thankfully, in the hindsight, everyone is super smart and intelligent. But if you look at the whole stand that the government and the regulators have taken, it is paying off for a lot of consumers who didn't, you know, kind of jumped in the crypto bandwagon and are really saved from a lot of heartache. So I think that's on crypto is what my stand is. And I personally believe unless you have a asset-backed token, the value is anyone's game, right? Unless it is backed by an asset. An asset could be anything. It could be gold. It could be real estate. It could be securities. It could be art, right? So unless you back the token with an asset, the value is just figment of people's imagination. So that's on crypto. On CBDC side, there is a definite use case because CBDC addresses a lot of issues that the physical currency cannot address, whether it in terms of efficient operation or even in terms of transferring the monetary policy decision to the last mile customer and the intermediaries in between, right? So I think in those cases, CBDCs does seem to be appealing, but there are challenges around privacy, there are challenges around transparency, government control. So those things need to be addressed, but I feel for democracies like India, CBDCs are still a much safer bet to at least start testing waters with.
So I think everyone has been asking when is the next world war going to happen, but I say that the world war is already happening, which is the Web3. And the industry stalwarts like Elon Musk and, you know, Jack Dorsey, they are not like too much eager to go ahead with Web3. So I think the question that lies over here is like, what are the major challenges that we face in the tech industry or the fintech industry? And how are you trying to overcome it? Like, I know this feels like an interview question, but still, we want our audience to know, like, what are the challenges that lay ahead of us?
So the whole Web3 story, if you look at it, right, at least for me, I don't equate Web3 with crypto. I don't equate Web3 with metaverse. And a lot of people do. They think Web3 is either DeFi and crypto, or Web3 is either metaverse and NFT. If you look at it, Web3 is none of those things. In my mind, Web3 is a concept which basically tries to address two basic things. A, there should be decentralized way of operations of enterprises who are working with, for the benefit of consumers. So there should be not one or big four. There should be no concept of big four, you know, or big three or big two or big one taking over the way they do things. That has happened in Web2, which people call where any industry you pick up. We have big two, big three controlling almost 70-80% of the market. Whether e-commerce, you take India, Flipkart and Amazon will control 60% of the market. If you take China, Alibaba and Tencent are controlling a very vast share of the market. If you look at US, again, you have Google and Facebook advertising industry there. So there are big two, big three, big four problem that has arisen. And the second problem is about data ownership, right? So currently, both you and I are using the Zoom platform and our entire interaction, even though, you know, they say they use encryption and all, but effectively it is there on their servers and they can do whatever they want. So the data ownership has to come back to users like you and me. And if we want to monetize the data in partnership with the platform that we are using, it should be our control. Currently, there is no control given to us that how the platform, which is Zoom in the case, can actually use our data. So in my mind, Web3 is about two things: decentralization of executing or running an organization, and B, ownership of data is given back to the user. Now, as a part of this, if you look at Web3 on these two principles, then I know the whole story about Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey, and you can also throw in A16Z, who has been a big proponent of Web3 as a phenomenon, and they are on the opposite sides of the stream. But I would like to allude to another gentleman, which I personally follow and listen to when he speaks, and he is Tim Berners-Lee, who is the founder of actual WWW. So probably he is worth listening to what he's saying. And if you look at his definition of Web3, it's very different. He doesn't talk about blockchain. He doesn't talk about he talks about decentralization, but he talks about decentralization without blockchain. So he's creating a different platform, which will allow those two things to happen that I mentioned, that the data ownership will go back to consumers like you and me without being using a blockchain, which could be terribly slow, which could be terribly difficult to scale, and which could be terribly insecure now that we are finding out that so many blockchains are getting hacked and this, that. So when Tim Berners-Lee says that, okay, decentralization is a good objective to pursue, but you don't need to do it on a blockchain because it has these problems, I can do it a better way. Probably I'm bullish on the way he is trying to bring Web3 to existence rather than the other thing that is going on in the market.
Right. So you mentioned, right, that there are always top two or top three. So we're talking about e-commerce, Flipkart, Amazon, and the likes. So India is again has come up with something that will probably disrupt the space of e-commerce when it comes to top three or top four, right? So enter ONDC, right? Open Network Digital Commerce that's come into India. It's going to, in a way, prove that consumer is king. But with so many entities being a part of this entire nonprofit organization, who takes the liability when things go wrong? How does technology come in and pitch in and play a role when you have so many moving parts involved? I mean, it does get a bit challenging at the end of the day. So how are things going to pace out in that particular ecosystem?
So it's going to be messy to start with. And I think that is where the industry regulators and the policy making bodies and even the government, the Ministry of SME, needs to play a very active role in the way the platform grows and develops further. But if you look at it, right, so we have ONDC counterpart, which is owned by a private company in different parts of the world, right? So Alibaba is like ONDC in China. And I was very surprised, again, I'll tell you, in Saudi, they are actually building ONDC. A private player is building ONDC, and it is getting support from the government. And okay, we have very similar initiative going in Singapore, where the MAS, in fact, before COVID, when I was working with PwC, we were working with MAS to create a ONDC kind of platform back in 2019. Which will facilitate SMEs in India and SMEs in Southeast Asia. So countries like Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, to kind of come on the platform and trade and use logistics, use marketing, use all kinds of benefits without actually going to centralized platforms like Amazon or Alibaba, which kind of dominates the all kind of cross-border e-commerce. So I think it's happening in different parts of the world. It's not like India is the only one who is doing ONDC, because you and I live in India, we think ONDC is good. And probably the scale of ONDC for India will be much bigger, just like UPI is, than in other countries. Because I feel what UPI has done for B2C transactions, where a customer like you and me can do quick transaction and buy anything that we want, it is going to do the same for B2B transaction. And what I mean by that is two things: capital B to small b, small b to capital B, and capital B to capital B, right? So you just see the immensity of that, that a two-person organization, which is small b, can trade with a two-person organization on the other side seamlessly, frictionlessly, instantly. And the same can happen between a capital B and small b on either side of the supply and demand side. So I think if you just see the immensity of this happening and the network that is getting built, so you don't need to work with delivery for all your logistics demands. You don't need to work with Udaan for all your e-commerce aggregation, demand aggregation. You don't need to work with HDFC Bank for all your financial needs. Just see how many small Bs can be brought on the network. And because it will be network, which will facilitate transparent decision-making by whoever is buying that particular service, the best service provider and the cheapest service provider will eventually win. So I think that's the vision that I see. If executed well, 5 years before, can anyone would have imagined that we would be using, everyone in the country will be using UPI. It was supposed to be a difficult thing, but we got there. So I think if you see that 5, 6, 10 years down the line, if we can replicate that success model in the B2B space, it can be a game changer. And I'll tell you, the game changer will be the 5 trillion economy that seems unachievable right now. It will contribute in a big way to that vision.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
You mentioned that it will be a matter of, the cheapest service will be taken. But then also there comes the question of deep discounts, where big retailers will, take it away. And again, then it will be a question of big two or big three. So is that a problem we are entering?
So it's not like that, right? So if you look at the whole concept of ONDC, I think whoever in charge will be in charge of setting up the pricing. They will ensure that the small players is not killed by the bigger players. And if you look at the whole system, right, the whole system is being put into place because they want to disrupt the big two, big three, right? And if the big two, big three actually come on the platform, it gives you a big endorsement that they see that it is actually going to disrupt their business. So they want to become a part of it. Just like you see ICICI Bank, HDFC Bank trying to partner with the fintechs that they ignored very, easily in the early days. So they realized that they can't just sit on the sidelines and let these business grow. So it should not be exclusionary because of the size of the business. But I think you're right. We should have some, parity between the bigger players and the smaller players, at least in the beginning. And all these things, because the network effects kind of starts playing its hand, you will have smaller players find niches where they can solve the problem that the bigger players are not even worth, going after. So those kind of niches will be the starting point before the network develops.
Talking about starting points, right? So let's divert a bit from this and start another topic as well. So I've been reading about it, open banking a lot these days. So it's revolutionizing the world of fintech again. So if you could please throw some light for our listeners as to what open banking is and how do you think it's changing the game in the entire fintech ecosystem today?
Okay. So if you look at open banking, at the end of the day, it again comes about the principle that I told you about Web3, which is the data ownership part. So currently, if you look at the data that is lying in the bank, banks think that they own the data. And in all, you know, practical purposes, they actually do, right? They know what is your income, they know what is your expense, they know which loan you have taken, from which bank you have taken, how you are repaying them, how much net worth you have, how much money you have invested in traditional asset, alternate asset, crypto asset, whatnot. So they know everything and they can use that to do XYZ, and they are, right? And half the time you don't even know how they are using it. So all the calls that you get for, to sell credit card or buy a home loan, mortgage, it's a function of the data that the company owns about you, right? So if you look at open banking, it is again about giving the ownership of the data, the power of ownership of your own data back to you, so that you decide how you want to use that data and who you want to share that data with in order to benefit yourself, not the company that may be using the data. So that is what is the primary guiding principle behind open banking. And if you look at different markets, it is coming from different segments, right? So for example, in Australia, we have open banking, we have open energy, we have open telecom, and we have, I don't know, some open insurance, open mortgage, this kind of thing. So it basically tells that it's not just the banks who have to allow customers to share data with anyone that they want to, but also energy companies, utility companies, telecom companies, they have to give the same power back to their consumers. So I think that is the realm that we are calling open finance or open data eventually, where doesn't matter where my data is stored. It could be a ride hailing company like Uber, it could be Amazon, it could be Swiggy, it could be ICICI Bank, it could be Netflix. Eventually, just see if I know who is storing what data about myself, and I can, you know, have the power to allow people who want to get my data in order to serve me better or serve me cheaper, I should be able to make those decisions. So I think that is the power of open banking. And you just imagine if you and I are in as a part of that decision making, that really unlocks the value for the customer and also the enterprise who may be trying to serve us but currently is locked out of the ecosystem because they are not big two, big three. They don't have the power to buy that data from XYZ and stuff like that. So that is the primary premise that I feel open banking will start, because banking data is probably the most high provenance data, right? Because, you know, your e-commerce data cannot be high commerce just because you are going to Amazon and typing, you know, iPhone 14 doesn't tell you that you actually have the affordability to buy iPhone 14. But banking data is a very high provenance data. It tells you exactly what is the affordability to pay, what is the willingness to pay, what is the state of the consumer in terms of expense patterns, income patterns, so that's the story around which open banking can be super transformative for the economy, but also for the digital lifestyle of the consumer.
So I think open banking is the future, and it has a lot of potential in itself. But while we are talking about the future, I think only 1% of the the whole India's population has invested, or you know, they are active investors in the market. So don't you think this future technology is going to increase the gap between the investors and those who are just staying over there as an audience? Like the rich will become even richer and the poor will become even poorer financially and informationally as well.
No, so I actually think it's the other way around, right? But I'll tell you why. Because, you know, India is actually becoming data rich before it becomes financially rich, right? And data is going to be very valuable. It is already very valuable. Because, you know, everyone has a smartphone, everyone watches things on internet, not on TV, where you can't capture who is watching what. So that data, people are not realizing today. A lot of people are not realizing the value of the data that you know, XYZ company, you know, why do you think Reliance and Airtel gives you free, not now, but when they started, they gave you a lot of free stuff, right?
Data is the new oil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not just the oil, data is now, you know, oil is still limited. The sunlight, and so many other things, because you can use it multiple times, it's unlimited, and this, that, right? So addressing to your question, the 1% who currently actively trades in the market. So if you look at it, it is a very supplier driven market. So somebody comes and tells you, why don't you invest in mutual fund? Why don't you invest in equity? XYZ invested, and they are gaining 30, 40, I don't know how much percent return, right? So that is a supplier driven market. Now it will be supplier driven market at least for some time, because India is not a very financial savvy and very, you know, I would say a digital savvy economy. Now, what will happen? Currently, the suppliers are still controlled by a few big firms. I'm not saying it's two or three, probably it's 20 and 30 firms who are actually trying to educate the customer and bring them into the market. Now, what will happen with open banking, or rather open finance? Let's say I am a registered advisor, right? I'm a small guy, I'm starting a business like a financial advisor. Today, in order to get the net worth of the customer and the income and expense pattern, it's a nightmare for me. My customer will have to go to the bank, get his bank statement, share it with me, a physical statement. I'll have to do all the calculation. Just imagine if he has the power to share all his financial data with me. I am a solopreneur, just starting off as a financial advisor in, let's say, a tier three or a rural market. If I can get the same access to data that a big financial company today gets, I can actually democratize access to investing and capital markets to a lot of smaller pockets of the country where they currently can't do that. So I think that could be a game changer. If you allow customers to share data with anyone that they trust, and of course you have to regulate all these advisors. They are anyways regulated by SEBI and other AMFI and few other players in the market. So I think that supplier empowerment, not at the institution level, but at the entrepreneur level, could actually bring a lot of new customers to the realm of investment and other financial services.
All right. Okay. So we put a lot of focus in this last answer on data, right? So a lot of having said that, data is an output of thorough research at the end of the day. That the ultimate aim is to make people aware and educate them with respect to any and everything that you're providing, doing the research on. So having said that, if you could throw some, and this would be my last question, if you could throw some light on WhiteSight, what WhiteSight does as a firm, because it's reimagining the way fintechs are, you know, and providing us with research and data to users at the end of the day. So if you could throw some light to the listeners on that, please.
Well, I'm delighted to do that. I'm happy that you brought that up. So when we started in 2020, November 2020, when we started, it was, you know, the peak of COVID. And you know, I was like getting this idea to start a research company, which will not just serve the bigger institution. Again, the whole story that you should democratize access to quality research and insights to anyone who can use those insights to build a business. And with that premise, we started the fintech research company. And it so happened, we got a lot of fintech startups as our first customer, who kind of trusted us with the data that and the intelligence that we were providing them. They built business around some of the data insights that we shared with them. Of course, I'm not taking credit away from them, but I just would like to feel happy that we had some contribution to the way we have kind of supported the business growth of some of these early stage startups. And our, you know, growth has been a outcome of two things. A, working on something dispassionately. So, you know, not getting biased because of industry reports, like somebody saying, okay, BNPL is the best, you know, next best thing. You know, trying to look beneath the surface and see whether, what are the risks, what are the things that people should be aware of. So that's one. And also, I would say the community support that we have gotten. So people from, you know, different parts of the world, not just the US and UK, but I have made friends with people from Peru, people from Egypt, people from, you know, Brazil, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, and the way the network has grown has a given new exposure to clients from those markets in some cases, but also helped us gain intelligence in how a single product like BNPL, if you look at it, or open banking, it's very different from one market to another in the way that it gets operationalized and executed. Because at the end of the day, financial industry is a heavily regulated industry. It's not like e-commerce, right? Which is pretty similar across the world. So those nuances of local economies come into play, and having actual people on the ground and getting firsthand insights from them has been super, super helpful in the way the business has grown.
I think Sharda University has this tagline, where are you? I think your tagline would be, Sanjeev Kumar is in the future, where are you? So it was a brilliant conversation that we had, and now we would like to end it with a quick rapid fire. We'll throw some words at you and you'll have to like give a word or a phrase for that same thing. Okay, so I'll start with mine. It will be BNPL.
Risky.
Digital currency.
Promising.
Aadhaar.
Empowering.
NFT.
Utility.
Paytm.
Downward.
That's an ouch from an investor who had gotten the IPO. Okay. Metaverse.
Long term.
Open banking.
I would say, I already used empowerment. So I would say democratization.
Blockchain.
Problem. Adoption problem. Adoption problem, yeah.
The last one from my side is Web3.
Optimistic. I'm optimistic about it.
Okay. And the last one from my side would be white side.
Okay. Global. That's what our aim is. We want to build a global business. So I hope we kind of move on with the initial vision that we set up.
Thank you for doing this podcast episode for us. And we were absolutely delighted to host this one with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.